From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, as the International AIDS Conference gets set to begin in Washington, where are we in the fight against the epidemic?
We have the tools, but we don't have a blueprint or any construction equipment.
Our cover story, Eradicating AIDS, is it within reach? And then, how this sound could determine whether or not you have Parkinson's disease. Plus, the mystery behind California's dying eucalyptus trees and a case of possible bioterrorism, and how a private investigator became the crime writer behind Savages and the Kings of Cool. Also, actor Donald Faison on the movie he could watch a million times.
Star Wars, the best movie on the planet.
Also, legendary rapper Nas on growing up.
In the past, I had to deal with issues that hit me as a younger man. I'm, like, dealing with different things now.
And the audition of a lifetime, a percussionist's year-long preparation for a chance with the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
I remember walking out on stage and thinking, my gosh, my footsteps sound as though I'm walking in the, you know, the halls of heaven.
That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. As the International AIDS Conference kicks off here in Washington, D.C. this week, we're going to take a closer look at the state of AIDS research and where it's headed. Later, we'll hear from former Olympic diver Greg Louganis on living with HIV and living well. It's almost hard to believe that just 30 years ago, if you turned on the nightly news, you'd hear this.
The lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic of a rare form of cancer.
21 years ago, this announcement shocked a city and the country.
Because of the HIV virus that I have attained, I will have to retire from the Lakers today.
Magic Johnson assumed he would begin to manage his own death. And yet today, it's very likely people like Magic Johnson will live to see Social Security checks and Medicare benefits. The biggest part of that reason, as we'll find out, is because of the breakthroughs in treatment. A new drug, Truvada, can actually prevent HIV, and it was approved by the FDA this past week. But the battle is far from over. 50,000 new cases of HIV are diagnosed in the U.S. each year. One of the worst-hit places right here in our nation's capital. HIV infection rates in Washington are higher than in some countries in Africa. And as NPR's Amy Held reports, African Americans are among the hardest hit.
There you go. And you just take it up your gum line like you're brushing your teeth. Make sure you get both sides full.
Alicia Barbour may sound like a dentist, but she's actually an HIV tester who operates from inside a van. Almost every day, she sets up the mobile testing van in some of the roughest parts of the city. This afternoon, she and other testers are outside a subway station.
Would you like to take a free HIV test?
Yeah.
Where you giving the test at?
Right over there. We have a green and a white van.
Alicia and other testers work for a community education group. They're part of the front line in the fight against HIV. Last year, the group tested 10,000 people in Washington, D.C. Del Torre is one of those people. He goes for a free test every few months.
I want to know. You know, I know friends that are affected by HIV, and some have died of AIDS, so I just want to be safe, just to make sure.
But not everyone is like Dell. Dr. Gregory Pappas, who heads up the HIV/AIDS Administration for the city's health department, says 20% of residents who are infected have no idea.
So in D.C., that means 4,000 or 5,000 people are out there on the streets living their life, they're HIV positive, they're spreading disease. Half of new infections come from people who don't know their status.
But the city is making some progress. Not a single HIV-infected child has been born here since 2009, and new infections among intravenous drug users are down 70% since 2006. Yet there's no doubt AIDS remains a huge problem in Washington, D.C.
We have two or three people infected every day in the District of Columbia.
And most of them are in the African-American community. Between 2006 and 2010, newly diagnosed HIV cases, not AIDS, rose about 20% among blacks, yet fell nearly a third among whites. So what accounts for the disproportion?
It's actually poverty and lack of education.
And while Dr. Pappas says a third of people in the city do get tested each year,
I think it needs to be about two-thirds. We're getting there. We've got to make testing normal.
Which brings us back to Del Torre, that man who decided to get tested. He tells Alicia Barbour he's had unprotected sex, but he's ready to hear his results.
The results that they are negative.
Good.
Engaged in a lot of risky activities.
Yeah.
So
I gotta be safe.
Yeah.
Getting too old. I'm in my 50s, time to slow it down. Thank you for your time.
No problem.
I appreciate it.
Del Torre falls into a high-risk group, but he's been lucky so far. He knows that. He says he'll be back to get tested in a few months.
That's NPR's Amy Held reporting on the situation here in Washington. Nationally, there is some reason for optimism. Jeffrey Lennox is a leading AIDS researcher. He's based out of Atlanta's Grady Memorial Hospital. And when he began his career 30 years ago, the AIDS epidemic was just beginning to take shape.
There was a huge need for physicians who were willing to take care of patients because at that point, all we knew was that it was infectious. We didn't know how easily it was transmitted from person to person. And there were literally young men in their 20s dying every day in the hospital, and I was just drawn to try and help do something about that.
What were those first few years like when you decided, this is what I'm going to do? I mean, were you seeing people dying in hospitals weekly, monthly?
Yes. I mean, taking care of patients at that point, once we knew how to diagnose it, basically everybody I took care of died.
It was managing their death?
Yes.
When did you start to see a change? The change from people being diagnosed with HIV, knowing that they were going to die, to knowing that they were going to live?
The amazing transformation was in 1995 when the first triple drug combination was available. And literally, I saw people who were on their deathbeds discharged from the hospital within a month.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It was the most amazing thing, and it's still amazing. We still get people who come in the end stages of AIDS. And if we catch them in time, many of them are restored to normal health.
So where is the state of AIDS research today?
For therapeutics, we have amazing combinations of drugs. We don't have a cure. So we're talking about lifelong therapy to suppress the infection. And most people will do just fine. We estimate that the average person who goes on treatment and suppresses the infection will live about 30 years. But I also tell them that it's up to them. You know, humans aren't robots. We're not programmed to take pills every day for the rest of our lives 100% of the time. And that's what HIV treatment requires.
My understanding is you can treat HIV AIDS to the point where it is almost undetectable in the human body.
Yes, but at Grady, we still have 200 people a year die of AIDS. The treatment is wonderful. It's amazing. But actually getting people on treatment is still very, very hard.
The CDC is saying that just about a quarter of those people who are infected in this country have their virus under control. So what can be done? I mean, how do you address the 75% of those who are not seeking treatment, getting the treatment that they need?
Well, of the remaining 75%, about a third don't know they're infected. So we need to make testing as easy as getting your blood pressure tested at a drugstore, for instance, so that there's no barriers to testing. The other third don't want to go into care. They're afraid that if they go to the doctor, that they'll then become ill. And the remaining third are in care, but they're not reliably taking their medication. So we have to develop innovative solutions for each of those three populations.
You started out as a young physician when this epidemic began. Do you mm-hmm. think when your career is over, you will see a cure?
I don't think in my career that we're going to see it. There has been one person cured, so we know it's possible. And people are working on it with new scientific tools. So there may be a breakthrough sooner than expected. People are optimistic because we have the tools, but we don't have a blueprint or any construction equipment. You know, we know where we want to go, but we don't know how to get there reliably.
That's AIDS researcher Jeffrey Lennox. He's also a professor at Emory University in Atlanta. Now, back in the 1980s and early 90s, an HIV diagnosis was assumed to be a death sentence. It's the fate that Olympic diver Greg Louganis thought he'd face when he discovered he was positive in 1988. He revealed it years later in an autobiography, but in 1988, he decided that he'd tell almost no one.
It was a really scary time because my thought was if I was diagnosed HIV positive, then I was going to do the honorable thing and pack my bags because I was training in Florida, and I was going to go back to California and lock myself in my house and wait to die because that's what we thought of HIV at the time. And so my cousin, who was my doctor, was treating me, and he wanted to treat me very aggressively, so they put me on AZT right away. He talked me into continue training, and so I did, and I just kind of moved forward. It was really a blessing for me at that time because diving was much more positive to focus on than my HIV.
when your book came out, and this is just 17 years ago, even at that time, there was a little bit of a backlash. I mean, you lost some sponsorships, and some people condemned you for not having revealed this earlier during the Seoul Olympics. Were you surprised by the reaction at the time?
No. I wasn't really surprised. When you come clean of secrets, I mean, there's going to be some backlash. But you know what? There was a lot of education that was happening at the time. People needed to learn how you get HIV, but also important to know how you don't get HIV, and you're not going to get HIV from a chlorinated pool. You know, really the only person that I put in harm's way was the doctor.
This, of course, is the doctor who treated you when you hit your head on the diving board,
right,
who sewed you up. He did not test positive for HIV. You went on, of course, to dive off that diving board 22 minutes later, ultimately winning gold at that Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, it was... It's one of those blessings that it doesn't seem like a blessing initially, but going into that Olympic Games in 1988, I was the favorite. I mean, I was expected to win. And then when that happened in that split second, I became the underdog. And, you know, it was probably a place that I needed to be in order to be successful at that Olympic Games.
How have public attitudes changed towards people who are HIV positive now from the time that you first revealed this in 1995 and when you first learned about it in 1988?
There's been a huge shift as far as awareness and understanding, but there's also a lot of misinformation as well. With young people, I mean, it really concerns me because they do see, you know, these healthy people, appearingly healthy people, you know, like myself, Magic Johnson, and the medications are better. Yes, people are living longer. Yes, we're having to worry about retirement and old age and all that stuff. But I wouldn't wish my drug regimen on anyone, so they shouldn't really think of it as a manageable condition.
That's Olympic gold medal diver Greg Louganis. He's headed to London, where he'll be mentoring Olympic diving hopeful David Budaya. And we'll hear more from Greg about that a little later in the program. And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Parkinson's is one of the hardest neurological diseases to treat. There's no cure, and it's very difficult to diagnose, particularly in its early stages. Part of the reason is that blood tests don't reveal whether you have it or not. Well, that may be about to change in a shockingly easy way. And it could start by placing a phone call and saying,
Hello, welcome to the Parkinson's Voice Initiative. We record your voice for clinical research.
We play to them various prompts. It tells them exactly what to do. In particular, the primary thing that we're looking for is for them to just say, for as long as they can.
That's Max Little, head of the Parkinson's Voice Initiative. He's created an algorithm that could determine whether or not a person has Parkinson's just by the sound of their voice. Max Little is an applied mathematician, and a few years ago, a researcher from Intel Corporation, which pours millions of dollars into Parkinson's research, approached him, and here's what happened next.
And they asked me, can your algorithm separate out those who have Parkinson's from those who don't? And so we tried that, and we were able to separate healthy controls from Parkinson's disease patients to 86% accuracy, and that's when we thought, okay, we've got something here.
How accurate is the algorithm now?
So we know that we can detect whether somebody has a disease or not to 99% accuracy.
99%?
That's right, yeah.
So tell me, how does your algorithm work?
There are three sort of clusters of symptoms that we're looking at. The first group are to do with vocal fold tremors. So this is looking for tremor in the way that your vowel sounds are produced, for example. The second type of cluster of indicators that we're looking for are to do with breathiness and weakness. The third kind of indicator that we're looking for, and this is relatively new actually in the literature, it's a new indicator, and that is to do with the way in which your jaw or your lips, your tongue, will slightly fluctuate during speech. And that turns out to be a very important indicator as well. But that's a very recent finding, actually.
So, Max, you have decided to create a database of voices, people with and without Parkinson's, in order to presumably to improve the rate at which you can figure out whether a person has Parkinson's based on their voice. Let's listen to one of those voices. This is a person without Parkinson's, and they're just saying,
Ah.
Okay, let's now hear somebody who has Parkinson's doing the same thing. Oh yeah, you can definitely hear that difference.
Right.
Explain what we're hearing here.
So this is really interesting. This person has quite obvious vocal fold tremor. Mm. It's the first of the three clusters of indicators that I pointed out. There is also an element of weakness and a certain amount of breathiness in their voice. That's also typical. So you can see two classical indicators of these symptoms occurring in this case.
Do you think there's any link between diagnosing Parkinson's through this voice technology and getting closer to curing it?
Well, this, of course, is very exciting. There's some evidence, admittedly weak, that voice disturbances may well be one of the first or early indicators of the disease. Now, if that is true, that means that if we can actually get to the population and record a large number of voices, we might have the opportunity to detect those people who could benefit from neuroprotective treatments. That is basically to look for cures. Because, of course, the problem with Parkinson's disease is that by the time it's being diagnosed, the damage is irreparable. So if voice, and I say it's a big if because we don't know this for sure, but it's a very tantalizing possibility, if voice is one of the early indicators of the disease, then we have a very cheap way for looking for those who are susceptible in the population. And we can target neuroprotective treatments at them to see whether they respond or not.
That's Max Little. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at MIT and the head of the Parkinson's Voice Initiative. If you want to find out how you can add your voice to the project, go to www.parkinsonsvoice.org. Max Little, thanks.
You're welcome.
Long before all the post-9/11 security precautions in the U.S., a person or a group of people carried out a series of bioterror attacks in California. And the target? The menthol-scented eucalyptus tree. Someone may be trying to kill them. Now, before you wonder why you hadn't heard of this, well, it's because the story may not be true. It's a hypothesis and a theory promoted by a famed California entomologist and eucalyptus expert named Timothy Payne.
Well, where we are right now is an area of eucalyptus that have been planted. Well, they probably are 100 years old, some of the trees in here.
Payne walks through a grove of eucalyptus trees on the campus of UC Riverside where he teaches. This is his outdoor laboratory, a test site, and on one of those trees, balls of white fuzz cover the leaves. Timothy Payne walks over and snaps off a leaf to reveal the culprit. Under that fuzz, an insect called a lerp psyllid.
They're feeding on the upper surface of the leaf, so what I can do is just put my fingernail right on the edge of the lerp and give it a little bit of a tug.
And there it is, a flat black and yellow bug that literally sucks the life out of the tree. The lerp psyllid is just one pest attacking the eucalyptus, but it's not the only one. All over this grove, insects are killing these trees.
In 1985-86 in California, we started seeing eucalyptus trees dying.
It began with a long-horned borer. That's a beetle that looks like a cockroach. As soon as Timothy Payne found a natural enemy to fight off the beetle, he got word of another pest.
We were seeing insect after insect coming in. We started working on the longhorn borer, and then another one would come in, and then another one would come in.
Altogether, over a period of 25 years, 16 non-native insects arrived in California, all of them with one main target, the eucalyptus. Payne got suspicious. He thought it was just too coincidental. So he started working on models, and what he discovered astounded him. Every 4 years or so, a cluster of insects from a particular place in Australia would show up in Southern California.
They would be from Queensland, or they would be from New South Wales, or they'd be from South Australia.
And for insects like the lerp psyllid, it's not so easy for those fuzzy white balls to hop onto a flight to Los Angeles. And that's when Payne began to suspect that these pests might be getting a helping hand.
You see something one time, you accept it. You see another pattern, you wonder if it's a coincidence. You start seeing five or six different patterns that all point in the same direction, and you start to raise questions.
Over the years, Payne has become more and more convinced that someone or some group has brought these killers from Australia to California, and the purpose? To get rid of California's eucalyptus trees. You're saying, though, that this was malicious.
We can't imagine that it was done for any other reason than that, yes.
In other words, he believes it's a case of biological terrorism. But if you're wondering why anyone would do such a thing, well, it turns out that the eucalyptus is actually quite controversial. Before 1850, not a single one existed in California. That year, some seeds from Australia were planted in the state. And today, it might as well be California's state tree. The state is covered with eucalyptus groves. But some environmental groups consider the trees invasive. Zoe Corbin is a science journalist who recently wrote about Payne's theory of biological terrorism for Failure magazine.
California's got fantastic and lovely native plants, and the native plant advocates argue that the trees sort of prohibit those from flourishing.
Corbin also says that native plant advocates point to another problem with the eucalyptus. Their dry, brittle leaves are a huge fire hazard, responsible for a particularly devastating fire in Berkeley in the early 1990s. Corbin says that if Payne's theory is correct, this could be the first documented case of an intentional introduction of a plant pest into the United States. But there's just one problem.
You have to remember that the evidence is only circumstantial. Nobody's come forward and put their hand up and said, I did this.
In 2010, Timothy Payne published his findings in the Journal of Economic Entomology, a peer-reviewed academic journal. It was met with some skepticism among other researchers. And here's what they told Zoe Corbin.
There's many more flights from Australia to LA than there was in the past, and it's very possible that something could have come in that way, you know, crawled on board and crawled out the other side.
Yeah, you can find alternative explanations for all of this, no question about it. This is something that we think is likely to have happened, but we don't have a smoking gun.
And without that smoking gun, Timothy Payne is out of luck. But he says for him, it's not just about the eucalyptus. It's about the possibility of biological terrorism that really scares him.
Eucalyptus are important for the state, but they're not life or death. But if you're talking about a major food crop or a disease organism, the prospects are very, very disturbing.
For now, Timothy Payne is moving on with his work. He's found natural enemies to fight 4 of the insects. The other 12, though, are still doing their best to annihilate the eucalyptus trees of California. Oliver Stone's latest film, Savages, opened in theaters earlier this month.
Ben went to Berkeley and double majored in business and botany.
This is the best cannabis in the world.
He takes 99% of the violence out of the business. The other 1%? Well, that's where Tron comes in.
The movie is based on the book by crime writer Don Winslow, and it centers around 2 young marijuana growers who live in Laguna Beach, California, and get tangled up with a Mexican drug cartel. His new book, The Kings of Cool, is a prequel to Savages, and it's set in 2005 when the main characters, Ben, Chan, and Oh, are just starting their business.
I wanted to tell an origin story in Kings of Cool. It's a generational story. You know, it's a story about these 3 young people who are trying to start something up, and they run into a wall, and it turns out that the wall is their own past. And so I go back to the beginnings, to the roots of the early drug trade in Southern California and Laguna Beach, all the way back to the 1960s.
Tell me about how you developed the personas of each of these 3 characters.
Well, you know, I used to live in that area. I used to live up in Laguna Beach, Dana Point area, and would hang out and do a little surfing. And so I got to know these kinds of people. You know, I got to know the Bens and the Chans who would hang out at the volleyball courts and play, and they would talk about their dads and their uncles. They would talk about friends of theirs back in the day. And so I started to hear stories about the early days of the marijuana trade.
Do you think you could write these characters and the dialogue you write for them without having known people like that?
You know, maybe I could have, but I don't think I would have gotten it right. It's funny, you know, sometimes editors from New York will express some incredulity, if you will, about some of the characters or some of the ways that they speak. And what I always say is, okay, get on an airplane. I'll pick you up in San Diego or John Wayne Airport in Orange County. And if I can't take you and put you in front of those characters in 45 minutes, you win the argument. But I've never lost that bet.
There's some great dialogue in both of these books. For example, one of the characters says, every great wine tasting should end with arsenic. And you read that line, and it tells you so many things about that character and about the world in which he inhabits.
Thank you, first of all. I try really hard to use small bits of dialogue to say larger things. and to give the reader an intro into character and into attitude. In that case, though, I think they're talking about sort of a class thing and what they like and what they don't and what annoys them, and I hope it does tell you something about character.
One of the things that makes you particularly well-suited for this kind of writing is your background. You were a private investigator yourself for many years.
I was. You know, I did. I started in New York City and then came out to California to do cases.
Did you always know that you were going to be a writer when you were a private investigator?
No. You know, I always knew that I wanted to be a writer. I sure didn't know I was going to be. But I used to sit and read. You know, I would be reading Elmore Leonard and James Ellroy and T. Jefferson Parker, sometimes while I was on stakeouts. And so when I got serious about sitting down and writing my first book, I thought, well, you know, it's a combination of something that you love reading and something that you know a little bit about, you know, which was the investigative world and the criminal world. And so I tried to put those things together, and here we are.
Talk to me a little bit about your writing process, because you have written now, I believe, almost a dozen books. Is that right?
I think it's more than that. I think it's a little shocking. I think it's more like 14 or 15. Yeah.
That's incredible. How do you do that? What is your average day like?
My average day is very much the same. You know, I'm a very routine, kind of boring guy. I get up at 5 in the morning. I start work at 5:30. I work until 10:30. And then depending on where we are, I either go hit the beach or I go run 4 to 6 miles, something like that. Come back, take a break, and go back to work until about 5 or 5:30.
Do you generally have a goal of a word count or number of pages that you want to reach every day?
I really don't. It's more for me like a factory job. It's a job that I love. I'm very grateful to have. But I really just think of putting time in at the desk. And some days are great, and I get a lot of pages done, and other days aren't so great. And I think it's like everybody's job.
Talk to me about the process of getting those drafts into shape. Do you sort of hand pages to your wife or somebody you trust while you are in the process of writing and rewriting?
You know, the story about Savages actually is that I sat down and typed the now infamous first chapter of that book, you know, two
yes,
words.
Two words. Yeah. Second one is you.
Yeah, the first one isn't. Yes. And then I wrote 14 pages in a flash, and I sent them off to my friend and co-writer and co-conspirator, Shane Salerno, in an email that said, either I'm crazy or this is really good. And he wrote back in half an hour and said, drop everything else you're doing and finish this book while you're in this headspace, which is what I did. But that's unusual for me. I usually don't show drafts to people. I keep it pretty close to the vest.
I have to assume you're working on something now as we speak. I mean, today, you're taking a couple hours to go to the studio and do this interview, but, I mean, you're going to go home and continue to work on the book you're working on now.
I say this with a little trepidation. I'm working on 3 books right now.
Wow.
I sort of have a morning book and an afternoon book. I like switching back and forth, and I don't think I've written my best book yet, so it's an exciting time. You know, I love getting up in the morning, and I love getting at it.
Well, that's writer Don Winslow. His new book is called The Kings of Cool. It's a prequel to his 2010 bestseller Savages. That film, directed by Oliver Stone and co-written by Winslow, is in theaters now. Don Winslow, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
All summer long, we've been asking people who work in film to talk about the movie that changed their life, including this one from the actor best known for his role as Christopher Turk on the TV show Scrubs.
Hey, I'm Donald Faison. I'm an actor, and the movie I've seen a million times, but that's not possible. My favorite movie of all times is The Empire Strikes Back, directed by Irvin Kershner. Executive produced by the great George Lucas. It stars Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, Billy Dee Williams, James Earl Jones.
Set your course for the Hoth system. General Veers, prepare your men.
I saw The Empire Strikes Back the week that it came out. My father was a huge Star Wars fan. And so when it came out, my dad took me. We watched it one time, and he was like, you want to see it again? And I was like, yeah. And he said, all right, act like we lost something. And so we started looking around our seats like we lost something. The usher left, and then they started letting in people again, and we sat right back down in our seats and watched The Empire Strikes Back for the second time that day.
Concentrate. Feel the force.
We spent a lot of money at the movie theaters. I want to say I saw it in the movie theaters 30 times. The Empire Strikes Back takes place a few years after Star Wars, when it opens up the Rebel Alliance, which Luke, Han Solo, and Leia are kind of the leaders of. They're running the show, and they're hiding out on this ice planet, hoping that the Empire can't find them. And the Empire does find them. Kicks their butt to the point where Han Solo is almost dead. Luke Skywalker loses an arm.
There is no escape.
And Princess Leia realizes that she is in love with a scoundrel.
Come on, admit it. Sometimes you think I'm all right.
Occasionally, maybe. When you aren't acting like a scoundrel.
Scoundrel?
You know, I mean, after seeing this movie so many times, there are a few scenes that stick out.
I like the sound of that.
Han Solo and Princess Leia in the corridor right after Han Solo has told the general that he has to leave the Rebel Alliance because of the bounty hunter they ran into at Ord Mandel.
General, I gotta leave. I can't stay anymore.
Princess Leia, she overhears this, and you know, Han can tell that she's sad. She knows she's sad, but she's got pride issues. She doesn't want to tell him that she's really gonna miss him and was hoping that they could develop some type of relationship.
Han!
Yes, Your Highness.
I thought you had decided to stay.
Well, the bounty hunter we ran into when Lord Mandel changed my mind.
Han, we need you.
And he's like, we need.
We need?
Yes.
Well, what about you need?
Well, what about you need?
I need.
She's like, I need.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And then she realizes she gave it up. She gave out the information he was looking for.
Come on. You want me to stay because of the way you feel about me?
Yes. You're a great help to us. You're a natural leader.
No. That's not it.
He's like, come on. She goes, you're imagining things. He goes, am I? Then why are you following me?
Fredo's going to leave without giving you a goodbye kiss?
I just assumed he's a Wookiee.
I can arrange that.
Then he yells, you could use a good kiss. You know, as a kid, I thought that was so pimp of Han Solo to read the situation. And I was like, if I could read women like Han Solo reads women, I'll be all right. I failed miserably, by the way.
That's actor Donald Faison talking about the movie he could watch a million times, Star Wars Episode V, The Empire Strikes Back. Faison currently stars in the TV show The X's. And it's time now for music. It's been almost two decades since rapper Nasir Jones, better known as Nas, released his first solo album, Illmatic. Now, the two things you need to know about Nas are, for starters, he is almost peerless among rappers, considered by critics to be one of the best of all time. And that record, Illmatic, also considered one of the best albums of the past 20 years. I rap for listeners, blunt heads, fly ladies, and prisoners. When Illmatic came out, Nas was just 20 years old, and he wanted to paint a portrait of the life he lived within the notorious Queensbridge housing project in New York. Just a few years before, Nas himself had been a crack dealer.
It was about bringing you inside my apartment. It wasn't about anything other than I want you to know who I am, what the streets taste like, feel like, smell like, what crackheads do. I wanted you to smell it, feel it. It's important to me that I told the story that way because I thought it wouldn't be told if I didn't tell it.
Nas is now approaching the age of 40, and on his new album, Life is Good, he's got a different story to tell. This is a record about coping with the aftermath of a failed marriage. Music notes on sheets, I wrote this piece to get closure. Some of y'all may know Khalees. This goes to her with love. On the album cover, Nas sits with a green dress draped across his lap. It's the only thing his ex-wife, Khalees, left behind when she divorced him a few years ago.
It's actually not her entire dress because it probably would not have fit in the picture. It was so big, but it took me a long time to really get through it. The album cover gives you that. It gives you what's been happening with me. It's wins and losses in life.
I'm wondering why you decided to open up so much about your personal life on this record.
Well, in the past, I had to deal with issues that hit me as a younger man. I'm, like, dealing with different things now, you know what I mean? I feel like every album doesn't have to be the same thing. Then it becomes a gimmick. If every rap album you make is about how you came up in the hood. I'm 38 now. This is my 10th album. I wouldn't want to hear someone be around for a long time talking about the same thing. I want to get to know this person. I want to I want to hear them give me something that I can relate to. For my brothers with daughters, I call this.
For my brothers with daughters, I call this. I want to ask you about being a father. You have a song called Daughters, and it's about your daughter. It's about something that really happened. She had posted a photo on a social media site, and there was a box of condoms in the background, and you wrote a song about this. How were you feeling when all that came out?
I felt like I wasn't there enough. I felt like she is putting on an act. She's home doing these things and talking like she's out in the world in the streets and making moves. And she's home tweeting these things. So I saw that she needed some attention. And I felt like, what kind of crappy dad am I that I didn't get to her beforehand? She look at me like I'm not the cleanest father figure, but she rockin' with it. For my brothers with daughters, I call this. For my brothers with daughters, I call this. Those things like that, really, it bothered me, and it bothered her mom. When I put out the record Daughter and I say, man, I should have drove her to school more, I should have been there more, I'm talking about myself too. I wasn't the best.
You have a line there that says, God gets us back. He makes us have precious little girls.
Right. So it's like, look at this. The guy who thought he was Casanova, now he has a daughter who has to deal with the Casanovas out there, probably, you know?
Let's hear another track off the record. This one's called Cherry Wine. I want someone who likes the champagne I like. My A, I like someone to talk me off the bridge any day or night. She teach me how to live. She ain't afraid of life. That song is, of course, about that elusive thing, which is finding the perfect partner, the perfect person.
Yeah.
Something that's eluded you as well.
Well, I thought I found one, and I don't know. It's just something that I don't know if we'll ever figure out. I hope I do while I'm here.
When you were married to Khalees, your wife from whom you split, did you think that was going to be forever?
Yes, of course. Of course, in the beginning.
What do you think is the problem? I mean, is it that you have a difficult time settling down?
I don't know if it's me. Hmm. It could be me. It could be. I don't know. That's the thing I was just talking to one of my boys about, like, when he did things with his girl, I realized I didn't do those things. I'm kind of a little rough around the edges. Like, come on, baby, let's go. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm missing a part. I mean, I open doors. You know what I'm saying? I buy flowers. I do those things. But there's a part of me that's still rough around the edges. And it comes off as insensitive. It comes off like I don't care. Like, you know, it's all about me, I guess. I don't know.
I want to ask about the last track on this record, which is about your ex-wife, Khalees, called Bye Baby. We hear you talking about all of the good that came from that marriage. At least I can say I tried, plus enjoyed the ride. Plus we got our little boy, my little joy and pride.
He got my nose, my grill, your color, your eyes. I just wanted to make that one real record about that situation. And I'm hearing, like, artists, men, famous guys, saying that song made him cry, and it just blows me away. For one, it means I nailed it. You know what I mean? Like, I nailed the song, and that to me is the greatest feeling of achievement, man. You don't want to disappoint, especially someone like me who's been out in music for years and hasn't had an album in like 4 years. I don't want to disappoint. That's a nightmare to me. So when I hear people love it or like it or even cry to it, it just says, wow, I did something right. I got it done. I'm not falling off. And that piece right there was something I just needed to do. That song, I had to. It was, to me, the most important record on the album.
And you sort of end it with one of the last lines says, watch me do it all again. It's a beautiful life. What is that thing that you'll do again?
Get married at some point. I want to be better at it. I want to be the best at it. It's a beautiful life. You learn, you win, you lose, but you get up.
It's legendary rapper Nasir Jones, better known as Nas. His new record is called Life Is Good. He spoke to us from our New York bureau. Nas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And in our music segment today, the story of chasing a dream. Earlier this year, percussionist Mike Tatro walked on stage at Symphony Hall in Boston for the audition of a lifetime, a job with the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
I remember walking out on stage and thinking, my gosh, my footsteps sound as though I'm walking in the halls of heaven. This is a place where music happens. This is a place where the ultimate of human expression through classical music is realized day in and day out. And it was exciting. I wanted to play. I wanted to play well. I wanted to enjoy every moment.
Mike had auditioned for other orchestras, of course. At the time, he worked for several in Colorado. But this was different. This was the BSO, one of the most coveted jobs in the classical music world. So how did he get there?
Growing up around the house, we always had Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops playing. The moment I knew I wanted to do music was listening to Star Wars the first time.
And so after growing up in Boston, Mike went off to study classical percussion at the Royal Academy of Music in London. And he made quite a career for himself. By last year, he was in his early 30s, living in Colorado, working as a professional musician. How are you, and you were earning a decent living, or what?
Yeah, in 2011, it was around 60,000. Last year, it was a little bit more. Put in a lot of hours, but I'm one of the fortunate ones. I get to do what I love for a living.
At the time, Mike and his wife were living in a one-bedroom apartment in Denver when one day he got word. The Boston Symphony was hiring, and not just one percussionist, but two.
As long as I've been in the classical music business, I can't remember one audition for two positions. This was a lightning in a bottle. And I'd say at the moment, there are somewhere between 200 and 300 people in the United States anyway who are willing to put in the hours and sacrifice everything for the opportunity, at least, to land one of these positions.
Mike, of course, was one of those people. After all, the BSO is among the best orchestras in the country and the best funded. You can make six figures playing there, benefits, vacation. It would mean a real working life for Mike doing what he loved in the city he loved. So Mike got a hold of the audition repertoire, and he started preparing.
Describe an example of the busiest day you had during the rehearsal process. Like, what would you do? You get up.
I remember one day in particular, and I got up at 6, and I listened for about an hour to the previous night's takes. That was recording a video.
A video. That's because the first part of the BSO audition isn't at Symphony Hall. It's a video you have to send in.
The video was a 10-minute run-through of 14 different pieces.
So after working a full day playing patchwork gigs, Mike would head to a rehearsal space where he'd stay practicing as late as 1 in the morning.
At around 1 o'clock, I figured that was enough. Got in my car, drove home, and I was asleep by 2, and I think I got up at 6 the next morning.
Now, this was more or less his life for about a year. Mike knew his video had to be flawless if he wanted to advance to the next round. Flawless on snare drum, flawless on cymbals, flawless on a Bach cello piece. And remember, Mike is a percussionist.
Yeah, it's very common for orchestras to ask transcriptions of Bach's solo pieces on marimba. And so they asked for the first 16 bars of that cello suite number 1 in G major, the Allemande movement, on marimba. You know, Bach on marimba is one of those things, if you put a note out, the world will know it. But more than that, it's, for me anyway, it's finding a way to express the music that doesn't sound too mechanical.
You also had to play a Gershwin piece on the xylophone, a piece from Porgy and Bess. Let's take a listen to this.
For me, that's why I love orchestra music. That the beginning of that, it sounds like Grand Central at 5 o'clock on a Friday. When I'm playing it on my own in an audition, I'm as much as possible trying to hear the orchestra behind it as I'm playing. Yeah, I often tell people, if you sat where I sat in the orchestra, you'd want to do it for the rest of your life, too.
Now, these are some of the most challenging pieces ever written, and sometimes featuring instruments you might not think about, a triangle or a tambourine, like the one in Dvorak's Carnival Overture.
Carnival Overture is one of those pieces that every single percussion audition will ask you to play it. It tests the limit of your tambourine technique. It's a lot of fun to play, but requires an awful lot of dexterity and coordination. For me, the tambourine part is, I've been to Rome a few times, and I always picture sort of the large piazzas in Rome on a festival day, and there's just a lot of noise and joy, and to play it feels as though you're staring down a rival band across the square and trying to make your celebration more joyful than theirs.
Mike's relationship with the music made all the difference in the end. When he finally sent in his audition video, and remember, this is just to get a live audition, he nailed it.
They invited to come and play live 30 or so of us.
And a few months later, those 30 musicians arrived to Symphony Hall, where they began to warm up in the basement. They prepared excerpts from over 50 songs on 9 instruments for an elite selection committee.
And I always find that part the hardest. There's a lot of people around. Some people are just getting ready for their audition. Some people have played and are packing up to leave. There's a lot of nervous energy down there. And I've always found, for me, it helps to not play a whole lot, but just to relax and trust my preparation and do the best I can. But once I get on stage, I finally feel like, I can breathe. Let's do this now.
On stage, but behind a screen.
Yes, the indomitable screen.
Because these are blind auditions. Nobody can see you. Mike sailed through his first 3 pieces.
The next piece was marimba, and it was a Japanese piece called Torch 3. It was very angular, very difficult, very technically challenging. And when I got up to play it, I just felt as though everything was a step away from me. I didn't feel as though my reaction time and my instincts and my ability to execute things the first time was really close to the surface, which is what you want on an audition day. And I got to the marimba to play the Torch 3, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, I just don't feel good about this today, but I'd rather go for it and fall flat than trying to be safe and more often than not make a mistake. So I went for it, and in the middle of going for it, which sometimes can happen on a marimba, we're holding 2 sticks in each hand. One of the sticks got caught underneath the row of accidental keys. I remember when it happened thinking, oh boy. And I had actually mentally practiced something going wrong in that piece. Oh boy. But what I hadn't prepared for was, I mean, literally the stick getting stuck in the instrument. I had to pull it out. And in the process, that threw things off, and I missed a few notes that made the rest of it come out uneven and a little bit hurried and sort of scattered. And so at that point, I thought, this isn't how I drew up the plans.
Later that night, Mike got the call.
I believe I was out at dinner, and I saw the phone ring, and I thought, there's no need to answer it. I'll be polite to her and answer. And I don't remember the words exactly, but what I remember hearing from the impression was, the audition committee would like to thank you so much for taking the time to come out. I knew my day was finished.
I regret to inform you.
We first read about Mike Tatro's story in the latest issue of Boston Magazine. That article has fueled a lot of discussion in the classical music world about the nature of professional auditions, whether the pressure is too high, the expectations too unrealistic. Mike's fairly conservative on all this, but he does think there is room for improvement. For instance, he was cut in the first round after judges heard just a small fraction of what he was asked to prepare. Mike thinks maybe they should hear everything first and then decide later. That this all happened back in January. How's mm-hmm. it been going since?
It's been going better. If I think about these auditions and this process as a narrative in which each chapter is slightly improved than the previous, then I'm encouraged. You know, if you do what you've always done, you'll get what you've always got. I'm an infinitely better player having gone through the preparation. So, yeah, I'm excited about this next round of opportunity and hope I can do my best.
That's Mike Tatro. He's still living in Denver. He's ramping up for another round of auditions early next year, although not with the BSO. After his story was published in Boston Magazine, people from all over the world reached out to help, offering tips and coaching. Mike says he'll take a few of them up on it. And a link to that story is at our website. It's by writer Jenny Doris, and you can find that at npr.org. For the week ending July 22nd, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show was directed by Petra Mayer and produced by Phil Harrell. Our production staff includes Brent Bachman, Andrew Fishman, Becky Sullivan, Lauren Silverman, Sarah Ventry, Megan Kane, Lily Percy, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Amy Held, and Beenish Ahmed. Michael Tomsik is our intern, Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for tuning in.